Please be seated. Morning.
Good morning.
Before we proceed, I'm going to introduce our students from Ashwaubenon High School. Would they please rise? Thank you very much for coming, and we hope that you will find this argument interesting. You may be seated. The students are here, as I explained at the first session, with our Court with Class program. And the Court with Class program is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and by the State Bar. Did I say that already? Good. I've got it memorized. The State Bar of Wisconsin and by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. The students here have gotten the briefs and may have had additional work on these cases. And as part of their coming here with Court with Class, they will meet with a justice at noon. So let me introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. And it is with Justice Patrick Crooks that you will meet at noon. Seated to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Prosser. I'll now call the case. 01-1590 and 01-1591, Mitchell Bank versus Thomas Shankey. And representing the Mitchell Bank will be Attorney Hugh Brown, who's at the microphone. He has 10 minutes. According to my notes, and Attorney John E. Knight, representing the Wisconsin Bankers Association, has 15 minutes, and 30 minutes will be taken by, and is it Welsenbach?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Representing Thomas G. Shankey, and 5 minutes, counsel. Mr. Brown, you have in rebuttal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, let's proceed. Right. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Hugh Brown. I'm a member of the Milwaukee law firm of Godfrey, Brown, and Frazier, and I appear here on behalf of the Mitchell Bank. With me at counsel table is Mr. Jeff Janik, who assisted on the briefs. Also, of course, is Mr. John Knight, the general counsel for the Wisconsin Bankers Association. The Mitchell Bank brings to the Court two narrow issues of concern to the banking industry and the credit industry. Those two issues, simply stated, are these. Number one, if a bank loses the note referenced in a real estate mortgage securing that note, does that invalidate the mortgage and prohibit the bank from collecting the underlying obligation? Both the trial court and the court of appeals said that it does invalidate the mortgage. The second issue is if a mortgage fails to identify the amount of debt secured in a so-called dragnet clause, a general clause which incorporates past, current, and future debt. If that clause does not specifically identify that debt and the amount of the debt, is that clause, that mortgage clause, unenforceable? Now, that second issue is extremely important to the banking industry because most of these mortgages and security instruments, I believe, do not specifically identify what we call antecedent debt, current debt, or place specific limits on future debt. And it is for that reason that I've asked the Court to permit me to yield to the general counsel of the Wisconsin Bankers Association, because while that issue is important to the Mitchell Bank in the specifics of this case, it has very, very, very great significance to the banking industry generally. And I made the judgment that Mr. Knight should appropriately address that subject. There also may be time to discuss a third issue raised by Mr. Welzenbach and Shanky, the waiver, estoppel, and latches issue. Now, with reference to that first issue, if the bank loses the note identified in the mortgage, does that invalidate that mortgage?
Counsel, I'd like to ask two questions about the first issue.
Right.
Number one, if the mortgage is invalidated, do we even get to the second issue? If there is no mortgage, then need we address another provision in that invalidated mortgage?
Oh, I agree. And that's essentially what the trial judge did. There was really only one issue before the Court of Appeals as we saw it, and that was whether or not the absence of that note invalidated the mortgage. That's correct.
With regard to my second question and the way that the issue posited, in reading the Court of Appeals opinion, especially with regard to paragraphs 24 and 26 of the Court of Appeals opinion, I did not read the Court of Appeals opinion to say, if the note is lost, then the mortgage is invalid. I read the Court of Appeals opinion to say, and again referencing paragraphs 24 and 26, that the bank has, in order to obtain judgment, has to prove the terms of the note and the default of those terms. And since the note apparently is lost, and looking at paragraph 24, the guy that testified didn't know anything personally about the events of the mortgage. The individuals who handled the transaction were no longer present with the bank. The notary wasn't there anymore. And in fact, the guy that did testify said he didn't know if there was a note, but that it was possible that if there was a note, it was destroyed in a flood. So, and then in paragraph 26, the Court of Appeals said, so the bank didn't meet its obligation of proving the terms of the note and the default of those terms. That's how I read the opinion. Tell me why you read it more narrowly, just saying that if a note is lost, the mortgage is invalid.
I do believe that the Court of Appeals did make reference to all of those things. In its ultimate conclusion, my read of that decision is that they simply concurred that if the note is lost, the mortgage is invalid. Now, maybe that was an explanation for that reasoning. Mitchell Bank's response to that is simply this. There was compelling proof of the obligation of the default by submission of other reliable evidence, which was undisputed at trial. That evidence, which replaced the evidence of the note, was the loan ledger of the Mitchell Bank and the general ledger of the Mitchell Bank, and specifically the write-off when these obligations, and there are really three of them, the Walkie note for $50,000, the Gary Butler obligation for 25, and the Miracle Shield obligation for 5.
Counsel, I don't want so much to address the sufficiency of the evidence, but just what the issue is. And I guess I'm reading the Court of Appeals conclusion in paragraph 29. I think that buttresses my interpretation. They say in the first sentence, the mortgage is invalid because, and I'm putting this in. Number one, the note cannot be produced, and number two, Mitchell Bank cannot establish the indebtedness secured by the note. So I see their holding more broadly than just notes gone, mortgage invalid. Do you disagree with me or agree with me?
Not really. I think overall the issue here is if a note is lost, what is the effect of that? Now, Mitchell's response is, that's a matter of concern. There has to be proof of that obligation. I agree with the Court of Appeals. And indeed, at trial, there was other reliable, competent, unrefuted evidence of the amount of that note, the fact of default, and that eventually, and these were reflected by quite specific records, the general loan ledger was intact. Thank goodness for the computer industry. And the general ledger was intact. And we also had the proof that the bank, in November 29th of 1988, actually wrote to the FDIC, which is its obligation, and advised them that these obligations were being written off.
Did that evidence that came in, and I think Justice Bradley is absolutely correct that the holding doesn't say no mortgage. I don't think that's what the Court of Appeals says at all. But their question was what is the evidence that other evidence of indebtedness? And you say the loan ledger, the general ledger, the write-off. Was there any other evidence that would indicate the date of the note, the place of the note, the amount, the duration?
There was other evidence.
There was what?
There was other evidence, Justice.
Yes,
indeed. First of all, the mortgage identified the amount of the obligation and the date of the note. The significant in the factual structure that went to the court, to the trial court, was that this note was initially, this credit was initially issued to Walke on September 4th of 1986, and that's an exhibit in the record. And $50,000 was advanced to Mr. Walke at that time. These notes were renewed on 90-day intervals, and the first renewal date was December 3rd of 1986. Now, unfortunately, we don't have the renewal note in 1986. But it was also renewed on March 3rd of 1987. And that note is in the record, and I believe in the appendix. It is in the appendix.
What page of the appendix, sir? Of the blue brief, I take it.
Yes.
Of your brief, yeah.
And
I've got the...
The Walke note is at page 143.
Thank you.
And the renewal is at 145.
Mr. Brown, my problem is that the trial court made findings. The trial court heard testimony?
Yes.
Trial court saw exhibits?
Yes, indeed.
And the trial court found that as a matter of burden of proof, meaning burden of persuasion, that the bank didn't, which had the burden of persuasion, did not prove that there was a May 7th note. The court went right through it. In fact, the court found it several times. The court said, hey, that's not good proof. You can start at page 6 of the trial court, 123. That's not good proof. Then looks at something else and says, that's not good enough. It keeps saying, well, the bank makes plausible arguments. But when you look at everything else in the record, it just doesn't meet the burden of persuasion. Ultimately, at 127, I am satisfied that matter must be ultimately dismissed for failure to note a burden of proof whether it is a simple burden of preponderance of evidence or obviously anything greater than that preponderance. I cannot find that the mortgage upon which the bank proceeds here today was in fact secured by a note surrounding additional consideration as stated in the mortgage of $50,000. When it comes to that on 128, when it comes to the mortgage dated May 7th, that it was in fact only intended to and only secure the note of May 7th. And she keeps going on and finding that you didn't, the bank never proved it on a preponderance of evidence. Now, those are findings of fact, right?
Yes, I would
And you're saying it's clearly erroneous?
Oh, yes, indeed, Your Honor.
There's not enough evidence to support the judge's finding.
No. I would say there is not, because I think we're getting – then we move to a question of law. The question is, if the bank loses the note referenced in the mortgage, is there any other way to prove this?
Mr. Brown, I'd suggest if the bank loses the note and you can show it ever was in existence and it was lost, then that would be all right. But this judge said you didn't show it was lost. She just doesn't think it ever was in existence.
Well, and our response to that is simply that there was overwhelming, dominant,
okay,
irreversible evidence that this money was advanced. And it's,
so we would have to clearly find that the judge's findings of fact was clearly erroneous.
Yeah. And I think that finding is supported by a proposition of law.
Mm-hmm.
The rule across the country, in all the cited cases, although this has never happened in Wisconsin, is that if the note is lost, it can – that the under – after all, the note is not really significant. It's the underlying debt that's significant. And
let's say that there was never a note. There was no May 7th note.
Right.
Let's say.
Sure.
Then is this mortgage any good?
I think there has to be the note. The note was specifically referenced in the mortgage.
But the issue of fact is it was it ever in existence or is it lost? Right?
Yeah. And there's never going to be any definitive proof on that one way or the other.
But I mean that's the issue. The trial judge has to say never in existence or lost.
Yeah.
Right? And she said lost. And you're saying that there isn't sufficient evidence to support that.
At least she said that. We say that this happens commonly, and in modern banking transactions where everything is done as computers and these things are multiply transferred to various holders, if it hasn't happened before in Wisconsin, it's likely to happen again. And the question then is how do you handle that? And what you do, I think, to get troubled about whether that note really existed or not is not the central issue. The question is, was there an underlying obligation? And there's no question that $50,000 was advanced and it was never paid. And that is the issue. And to say that mortgage is cannot be used to enforce that obligation is contrary to existing law. And it would not be good policy to modify that existing law by simply an arbitrary ruling that a note, if it's lost, destroys the bank's ability to collect the debt.
Mr. Brown,
no.
It would seem a relatively easy matter to have called to the witness stand or to have taken testimony from Mr. Waltke or Mrs. Waltke to prove up the obligation and the failure to pay. Was that ever done?
No, it was not. And I was involved in that and responsible for that.
I don't mean to
embarrass you. No.
I'm sorry.
But the fact is, and this is, by the way, a crucial part of this case, Mr. Waltke and Mrs. Waltke were served. They appeared by Attorney Scott Lowry, and they did not file an answer. There was a preference not to get involved in this. But they, by that conduct, they admitted, don't you see, They appeared in the action but did not file an answer. And under the statute, what is that? That's an admission of all the allegations of the complaint. So how, back to Justice Abramson's question, how can we have a denial that this note existed when the person who wrote the note and wrote the mortgage admitted all of these allegations by failing to answer? Now, was it possible to call them if they didn't want to appear in this matter but objected to everything? The judgment was made that let's go ahead.
Oh, your answer about the complaint satisfies.
Sure.
Thank you.
I am out of time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Knight.
Good morning. I'm here to represent the Wisconsin Bankers Association, the amicus in the case. My name is John Knight. And to address the second issue that Mr. Brown mentioned, and that is the clause in the mortgage which says it secures other debts and other obligations. The mortgage is in two parts, one in consideration of a $50,000 note, which your questions have addressed so far, and second, to also secure other obligations, old ones which are unpaid, current ones outstanding, or those that might be incurred in the future. This Court, the Court of Appeals, decided that that clause was not enforceable because it did not state a dollar amount. And that particular decision, we believe, is contrary to our statutes in this state regarding mortgages, which do not require that a dollar amount be identified with respect to a clause like that that says it secures other debt. It's also contrary to the case law in our state, starting with the Capicasa decision all the way back in the 1960s, when this Court first addressed clauses like this and laid down the law. Our courts have followed Capicasa more or less since then, and it's pretty clear now that the law in our state is that a mortgage simply needs to state in clear terms the debt that it secures with respect to antecedent debt. We don't quarrel with that. It's a matter of looking at the mortgage. Does it clearly state what debt it secures? We believe it does. It's not necessary, though, to go forward from that point and say, in addition to that, we must also identify the dollar amount of that outstanding debt. That's a requirement we believe came right out of the blue. It's a misinterpretation of the Badger State case decided by a prior court of appeals, and is quite inconsistent with a long line of cases involving this court.
Recognize that the dragnet clauses are not favored.
They are not favored.
And they are looked on with some skepticism.
They are carefully scrutinized.
All right, carefully scrutinized. And the doctrine is, quote, no surprises.
And no surprises.
Right. And does that mean you have to look at each dragnet transaction? Because if you're going to carefully scrutinize it, you have to look at each transaction, right?
You would have to look at each transaction. The financial institution would have to establish the debt, which it's required to do. The court may decide whether that debt's clearly identified by the terms, which does not mean specifically identified.
In the practice, and that's why you're here, because you're the represent the Wisconsin Bankers Association, and you know what the practice is. And if I understand your argument, there's been reliance, you think, on the concept of dragnet is okay, subject to scrutiny.
Yes.
And that's been the practice. So in most or many, let's take most first. Dragnets, do they list the antecedent debt? Now, we have to separate future debt and antecedent debt.
Correct.
Do they list the antecedent debt?
I would say most do not.
Okay.
In fact, there was we included, attached to our brief, was a sample form used by many banks.
This is not a mortgage form.
But it's interpreted by the courts as a mortgage.
That's right. But let's get away from the real estate security agreement,
right,
because there it's for consideration now, right?
Correct.
To extend credit any time in the future is a line of credit, and you give them it looks to the future here, although it can, it
well,
says antecedent.
It also includes
also
prior obligations between the parties and future obligations between the parties, not necessarily a line of credit.
This is a special form.
Well, it's a form widely used by financial institutions where they expect multiple transactions with their customers.
Let's move it away from that agreement. And I noticed that that's really the essence of your brief. And just put it into a straight mortgage form that we've
okay.
got.
Mm-hmm.
Does that straight mortgage form, is that used mostly for antecedent debt, or do you go into the RESA?
Well, certainly, as you know, from this case, the form used by this bank, and I believe a number of banks, uses prior debt. You'll find a whole variety of mortgage transactions out there. Some will be very specific to a particular note. Some will be with these clauses, and they'll generally say past as well as future. And I think that I know you want to get away from the real estate security agreement, but that's such a part of banking practice that it's hard to say it's not a mortgage when it's treated.
But it's just for the moment.
Okay.
Just look at a straight mortgage. What's the practice? You do or don't list?
The practice is a variety. That is the practice.
Okay. So at least some would list.
Yes.
All right. Any? Most? Do you know?
I do not know, but I would say many. But how many, I could not tell you.
Right.
It is significant. And if this court were to adopt what the Court of Appeals did, it would clearly be affecting a substantial number of existing transactions. About that, I have no question.
Well, if the court said in the future, you have to list this. You have to list all your antecedent debts. What would that do to the banking business?
Well, the banking business would have to find a way to do it in the future, and it would. But
it's not a particularly onerous.
Well, it can be. One of these cases, for example, there were like 36 transactions secured by the same underlying mortgage or real estate security agreement. It is difficult, particularly with financial institutions, which branch offices in many counties, to gather all of that up to list. As lawyers advising clients, we often say, don't be specific because you'll forget something. State the broad rule. Or if you're going to be specific, say including but not limited to, and list something. There is a great fear and a real concern that is if you get real specific, things will be overlooked and not listed, particularly in multiple transactions, multiple files. In this case, for example, Watke had a continuing business relationship with this bank. There was a business note already outstanding. There were two guarantees that he had executed already outstanding. Presumably, he knew what he owed this bank. To get back to the issue or the policy you mentioned, about no surprises. He couldn't have been surprised. He knows the guarantees that he's executed. He knows the notes that he's executed. He's now signing a mortgage with a very substantial clause that tells him what is secured by the mortgage. So it's hard to say that this is somehow violative of the public policy of no surprises.
Well, why is the bank surprised if he's not?
Why is the bank surprised? I'm not sure that they are. I think that going back to the earlier questions about the importance of the note, the bank argued all along the way and stated in its original complaint that the obligations secured by this mortgage were not only that note, which is missing, but the other obligations as well, and kept trying to persuade the trial court and the Court of Appeals that even if this particular missing note is missing and not found, there are still the other obligations that are secured by the mortgage. But they never allowed the bank to get that far because they would strike the clause saying it either was not intended by the parties or didn't state the dollar amount, or they had a variety of reasons, but they would never allow the bank to pursue the clause and the other debt.
Just so I understand, and I've got a timeline sheet here, but the on the appendix of your Mr. Attorney Braun, page 144, this check for $50,000 that was issued This is the one that we're relating to. In other words, this is when he said there was a lot of evidence, and this is or is not the 50,000 that we're talking about. That is not the 50,000. That is the 50,000.
What's the date of it?
It's dated. I'm just looking at the date of it is September 4th, 1986, and it's a cashier's check. So I just wanted to make sure that I was not misconstruing that. Thank you.
Just as a follow-up to that, I believe that the bank's the bank's witness at deposition testified that it was the February 3rd, 1987 note at deposition he testified that was what was referred to in the May 7th mortgage. However, at trial, then he changed his testimony. But that's one of the reasons. It's my sense that's one of the reasons that the trial court was having difficulty finding proof because of Mr. Croak's testimony initially that there was no May 7th note, but rather the May 7th mortgage referred to the February 3rd note, which had been paid in full, he testified to at his deposition.
The February 3rd note goes back to the September 4th note because I gather none of these were. At least it's arguable none of them were paid.
May I pass on my observation about this note? When you look at the mortgage, it says, in consideration of a $50,000 note dated May 87, we give you a mortgage to secure the following debts. And there the obligations are described in that clause about all the debts that are secured. The fact, at least in my view, the fact that that note for which the mortgage was given in consideration no longer exists doesn't matter that much. It may have been paid the following month. It may have been lost the following week. It may have been trampled under by a herd of cattle. I'm not sure it matters. The document says, the mortgage says, in consideration of that note, we give you a mortgage to secure all these obligations.
But didn't the trial court indicate that the court wasn't sure that the note even existed? The May 7th note referred to in the May 7th mortgage even existed.
They do express some misgivings about its existence and whether it did exist. But
let's say it didn't exist. Did not exist.
Did not. Okay.
Is this mortgage any good as to that?
My view of that, the mortgage has to be given, and it's something, there's got to be consideration for that mortgage. All the other debt is prior debt. So something needs to be going on in the relationship for you to get a mortgage that's valid. Consideration. The consideration is stated to be that note. Now, if the note doesn't exist at all and never did exist at all, and there's proof of that, then you've got to question whether there's consideration for the mortgage. But the bank has, with its ledgers and so forth, has demonstrated the debt, can't produce the document.
And if there's no consideration, because there is no such note, then can item 4, which is the dragnet, if I've got it right, can that exist?
Well, if the mortgage doesn't exist, none of it exists. And
but Mr. Brown said...
Right. I mean, there needs to be consideration. It could be that note. It could have been the renewal of another note. It could have been forbearance on collection. It could have been a variety of things that went on that would constitute consideration.
So with regard to that first issue on consideration, it's your position that the court erroneously exercised its discretion when it found that the May 7th, 1987 mortgage was invalid because it was not supported by consideration.
Well, she said the note, you couldn't find the note, and without the note, you don't have a mortgage. She then declared the whole thing invalid. The bank said there are other obligations, and she didn't give the bank the opportunity to carry that argument forward.
So even if there wasn't a May 7th note, is it your position there's other consideration here?
For certain. Other considerations, I mean, could easily have existed.
It's not stated on the mortgage.
It is not, right, it just says in consideration of this note, I give you a mortgage to secure all of these debts. And the bank, through its documents, believe it's had demonstrated the consideration.
The consideration being?
The obligation. It can't find the document, but it finds the obligation that they just mentioned by the cashier's check.
So the only consideration you're referring to is the $50,000 obligation secured by a note that it's your position did exist and was the subject of the May 7th.
Correct. They can't find the document. But I'm not sure that matters. Again, with the consideration, what took place on that day? Did it exist on that day? It doesn't matter whether it exists today or not. It could have been sold a month later. You had consideration when you took.
Let me get to the essence of my concern so you can address it straight on.
All right.
The essence of my concern is this, that the trial court made a finding that the bank really had not met its burden. Burden, again, referring to 127 in the appendix, that she's the trial court says ultimately it must be dismissed for failure, a burden of proof, whether it's simple burden of preponderance of evidence or obviously anything greater. In other words, the court, as I understand page 127, indicated the bank failed to meet its burden of proof of establishing that this, that there was consideration.
Well, I thought it was more narrow than that.
Whether by note or whether by testimony of the notary or the people involved in the transaction or testimony by anyone that the state, that the bank failed.
I just can't believe that's substantiated by the record. When you look at the records produced by the bank, the unpaid obligations, the cashier's checks, none of which, to my knowledge, was refuted, at least that I can pick up in the subsequent briefs. That was not acceptable for some reason, and I don't understand that. The focus seemed to be on the physical document, the note. And since you no longer have it, you must never have had it. I don't think we need to go that far. The question is whether you had it when you got the mortgage.
Well, look at page 130 of her findings. She says that she's looking at the document. She's saying, she's looking at the four corners of the document.
Correct.
She says, there's no May 7th note. That's what she finds. Then she says, as a result of the dragnet clauses contained in the notes that the bank attempts to claim this mortgage secures, do not apply as this mortgage was never intended by the parties to secure other obligations as evidenced by the plain reading in the four corners of the complaint.
Correct.
And then she looks at the bank's failure to object in bankruptcy and the bank's failing to do a whole lot of things that it wasn't, the Watkins didn't intend that this mortgage should be secured by anything else. And it's a waiver, she says, of their right to now claim that it is. Isn't that a consideration argument?
I read the complaint. I read the complaint this week, and the bank alleges all those debts specifically. So I don't know where that statement, the four corners of the complaint, I don't know from what that could be derived. And the failure to appear in a bankruptcy proceeding, that's a judgment call. Its mortgage is going to survive the bankruptcy. Maybe there are no assets. Maybe there's no need to appear. And to say that's estoppel and that's waiver strikes me as a bit of a reach as well. But to say no intent, not a single person testified, as you've already pointed out, at that trial who was present at the closing on the loan. The borrowers didn't testify. The bank officer didn't testify. How do we arrive at their intent?
But isn't that the burden of the bank to show that? And if you can't figure out the intent, then you just look at the plain language and there it goes.
The bank certainly had the burden of proving the debt secured by the mortgage. There's no question about that.
I understand the Bankers Association position, it's that don't get rid of all dragnet clauses just on the grounds that you didn't show antecedent debt.
Absolutely.
You list the specific antecedents.
Absolutely. Your existing case law is good. We've relied on it. We understand it. The industry's followed it for decades. It keeps being tweaked here and there, but it's satisfactory. It works. But to state something arbitrary like a dollar amount simply is going to throw the industry into a difficult, very difficult position.
And do you view the failure to answer that complaint by the Watkins as conceding all the elements?
Well, I do. I mean, they were...
They were parties.
They were parties. And presumably they were served and chose not to contest any of it. That strikes me as pretty significant.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Knight.
You very much.
Are there any other questions? No. All right. Mr. Wilson, back.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, my name is Joseph Welsenbach, and I represent Mr. Shankey. I've heard the expression before that bad facts make bad cases, which makes bad law, and I think this is a prime example of such. We're dealing with a case here where the bank not only lost supposedly a note that was in existence because of a flood, which we have no idea when, where, or how extensive it was. It lost the mortgage. It doesn't even have the mortgage. We know that no money exchanged hands, I guess no money exchanged hands on May 7th. When the bank president writes to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, he never mentions any mortgages. Not only did they have supposedly this mortgage, they had a mortgage from February, which nobody knew about.
Counsel, just so I know the facts are okay. Complex, but the mortgage you refer to, you're saying the mortgage was lost also? I knew the note was lost.
Sure. There is no original mortgage that they produced.
You don't have to worry about it because it was recorded.
I'm sorry, Judge.
It was recorded.
It was recorded.
But the mortgage
was. Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, the mortgage was recorded. That's what I was going to say.
The mortgage was recorded, but there's no original mortgage, and the testimony at trial was that when the bank holds the original mortgage, and when that mortgage is paid, that mortgage is either destroyed or given back to the mortgagee or mortgagor. Now, that could be what happened here, too. This note, this supposedly lost note, this note could have been sold to another creditor. This note, or on the other hand, this note may not even have existed at all, because we know that in the trial brief, the...
You'll have to stand in front of the microphone, otherwise you don't get recorded. So
in the trial brief that the bank submitted, it said that this mortgage was given for prior debt. And now it's arguing that we had a note, but we lost it. I don't, in all candor... I don't think there ever was a note on May 7th. I would have some stronger statements to make about what I really think happened, but we'll confine it to the record. There's absolutely no proof of a May 7th note here. And when I think Justice, I'm sorry.
Let me tell you the trouble I have with your case. There's no question that the bank borrowed or lent to Waltke $50,000. No question that they didn't get it back. Okay. No question that the bank secured, that this mortgage at least originally secured, was to secure this $50,000. That's been admitted because it wasn't denied.
Well.
Isn't that correct?
I don't
That's
agree with that.
That's the law in the state, isn't it?
I don't agree with that. I think under Section 840.07, the court has to look past the default provisions and has to analyze whether or not, in fact, the facts support a finding of default. Just because they don't answer doesn't mean that that is ipso facto an admission. The trial court has to look at it under 840.07 as well as other case law and determine if the facts support a default judgment. Here they do not. They do not support a default judgment. There's no May 7th note, and it just isn't supportable.
Well, there's other notes. There's notes, all kinds of business notes going back to 1986, May 29th of 86,
sure.
November 3rd of 86.
Sure.
But those are not secured by a mortgage, huh?
Those are not secured by a mortgage. This mortgage specifically says a May 7th note. If they wanted to say a September 1986 note, why didn't they say it? Or a March 3rd note? There just is no mortgage securing these other notes. And I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to bootstrap some prior debt into
current.
I don't
know what they're trying to do, but it smells to me like you're arguing, I used the term in the last case, but it smells to me that the bank has $50,000 coming from the Waltkes, and of course the Waltkes are in bankruptcy, so they can't get it, but that this note clearly that this mortgage was clearly designed for that May 7th note. I mean, just everything in my mind flows to that.
Okay, the May 7th note.
Yeah.
Did they get any money on May 7th? No. The May 7th note, what has the May 7th note?
I see a record replete with a refinancing and a refinancing and a refinancing and a couple in trouble, and the bank is helping them stay alive by continuing to refinance this note, and now they're being taken advantage of because of they don't really have a note in the record.
If this was a refinance of which note? It wouldn't have been. The last note that Waltke signed for $50,000 was March 3rd. If they were going to refinance it or renew it after 90 days, they would have renewed it on June 3rd, not May 7th. Okay? This is a totally, totally different situation. And if he had a note on March 3rd, why didn't they have a mortgage dated March 3rd? You know, I can't answer the questions because the answers aren't there with the bank. They don't have the records.
When did the Waltkes acquire the property in issue here in Waukesha County?
I don't know for sure, but I'm going to assume in the mid-1980s. I don't know that for sure.
If they had it in, when the March note was executed?
I'm certain of that, sure.
What about the September 86 note?
I'm certain they would have had the property then.
So if it was to secure that property, that would have been a good time to do a mortgage.
I would think that's when the bank would want to do it. If they're loaning $50,000 in September 1986, why wouldn't they get a mortgage for that amount?
Well, but you know, now that I've clarified that, or maybe not, you know, these people do owe the $50,000. It hasn't ever been paid from September 86, has it?
I don't know, Judge. I don't know if it's been paid. They don't have any records.
Counsel, your debt is...
The record is replete with the fact they didn't pay $50,000. How can you stand there and say you don't know?
Because their records are insufficient. I'm assuming they didn't pay it, obviously. When you say, do I know that for a certain fact, I don't know that for certain. I certainly would agree, in all probability, they have not paid it. That's what their records that they've reconstructed attempt to show.
Counsel, how does this enter in? When the bank's witness, Mr. Croak, testified at his deposition, and he testified that what was really meant on the May 7th mortgage was to refer that there was no May 7th note. He testified that it was really to refer to a February 1987 note in the amount of $45,271.98, not $50,000. And he testified at his deposition that that note, which was really meant to be the May 7th note, had been already paid in full. How does that enter into all of this?
Judge, other than showing the confusion itself in the bank itself, I guess my position originally was at the time of trial that the evidence, when he said the February note was really the subject matter of the March note, or of the May mortgage, and that it was paid, I thought that was the end of the case. The mortgage, the money was paid.
Because that's what he had testified to at his deposition.
Right.
That it had been paid and there really was no May 7th note. It was really the $45,000 February 3rd note.
Right. But it became confusing, I think, for him at the trial because I had shown him another mortgage dated February of 1987 for $146,000 that neither he nor anyone else at the bank had any awareness of. And they didn't know what happened to that mortgage, if it was ever foreclosed on or whatever. And that's how the record sits today.
And then he said, well, to the best, then after he did that, he said, well, to the best of my knowledge at this time, I believe that, and then he was interrupted. So his testimony changed a bit. Am I correct or incorrect?
You are correct. It changed from the date of the deposition to the date of trial. In any event, it would appear that at the testimony of Mr. Croak that I've appended in Appendix 16-17 of our brief, he indicates that the note of May 7th might even be paid. It's even possible that it might be paid. That's what he testified to. I thought Mr. Brown agrees that the note must be proven in order to enforce this mortgage. And I think that's what this case is about as far as the Court of Appeals decided. They decided that since the underlying note was not proven, that the bank could not enforce this mortgage. In respect to...
And is it your position that even if there wasn't a May 7th note, that there were prior other notes that were due, and that these antecedent debts could have been a consideration? I mean, that's part of the argument that I heard.
Part of the bank's argument?
Yes.
My position is this. When the mortgage, and this is a mortgage, not a RESA, when the mortgage specifically refers to a note, May 7th, and an amount, $50,000, that the bank has to prove that underlying note and indebtedness. As we know, the statute of limitations has already expired on the note, so they're only enforcing the mortgage. Now, can the bank, failing to produce that note, failing to prove that, can the court, the bank then say under paragraph 4 under the dragnet clause, we want to show you all these other debts and then under the dragnet clause prove those up? I say the Wisconsin law is clear, the way I read it, that antecedent debt must be described in clear terms, meaning it's got to be several different things. Either in the mortgage itself, you refer to the gross amount of the debt, $200,000, whatever it might be, or you additionally, in the mortgage, recite the other notes that you are securing by this dragnet clause. Thirdly, you can append a list of such debts to the mortgage itself, and they can be subscribed by the borrower and the lender, so that there'd be no question of what this mortgage covers. Because when Judge
Foster
said within the four corners of the complaint, I think she really meant within the four corners of the mortgage, because within the four corners of the mortgage, we're really talking about this $50,000 note. That's what it says. My argument to her was that the specific should control over the general. This mortgage is really a contract. Contract law always pretty consistently holds that the specifics control over general language. The specific here is the $50,000 note. And if they can't prove it, they cannot enforce this mortgage. That's our position. Obviously, we have other arguments about the dragnet clause, why we think it should not apply in this case, but our main argument is that because it must refer to the underlying antecedent debt, which it doesn't.
At all times, suppose there was a May 7th note here and it was proved, brought in. Would you say that the dragnet was okay?
No. I would say that they're limited. I would say they're limited to proving up the May 7th note. And I don't think I'm misreading or overreading these cases. I thought it was pretty clear from the Miller case, the Badger State case, that the court always says, in clear terms, we must identify antecedent debt. And it seems like that would be good practice under what the Osborne says and the American Law Institute indicated and those different types of scholarly people.
Counsel, your opposing counsel would suggest that paragraph 27 of the Court of Appeals opinion with regard to the Dragnet Clause states the law incorrectly. The last sentence of that paragraph indicates what the Court of Appeals says an obvious corollary to this axiom, that is, if the amount of debt is not both stated in the mortgage and identifiable from the mortgage document, the mortgage is not enforceable. Do you think that's a correct statement of the law?
I think it's a correct statement of the law, and I think it's the converse of what the court said in Badger State, meaning if the amount of debt is stated in the mortgage and is identifiable, it's enforceable.
Does the amount have to be specifically stated in order to meet the Schmidt and other court tests that it be identified in clear terms to meet the policy that there's no surprise? Does it have to be specifically stated? Your opposing counsel representing the bankers would say it doesn't have to be in dollars and cents stated.
Well, I think it should be stated in dollars and cents as the amount is due as of the date you're signing the mortgage. And I
said it should be, and maybe I agree with you, okay. It should be, but I'm asking what the law requires. Does the law require it to be in specific dollar and cent amount in order to meet the legal tests?
I say yes. Under Badger State, and the Court of Appeals says if the amount of debt is stated in the mortgage. So
how do you deal with the Schmidt case that indicates the standard is it has to be identified in clear terms, and in the absence of testimony to the contrary, it seems to me that Schmitz allows the court to presume that both the bank and the customer, quote from Schmitz, knew of their prior indebtedness when they signed the mortgage.
Correct. I think the Schmitz court says they assume that they do that. Well,
in other words, even if, as I understand it, that even if it isn't set forth in specific dollars and cents, that the court is going to assume that the bank and the customer know of what prior debts they're talking about, and in the absence of any testimony or suggestion by the customer that they don't know of it, that it's clear enough.
Well, the problem I have with that is I don't think we can make that assumption. And if we read the ALI restatement of law on that, they also indicate there's a problem with that. We can't make that assumption. And I think for a couple of reasons. While we certainly are presumed to have read contracts that we enter into, I think this court can understand that a clause like this may not come to the attention, to the full attention of the borrowers. In fact, in this case, Mrs. Walsky signed this mortgage, but she didn't sign any of these notes. So is she, you know, we get into that Capo Casa case situation where maybe she shouldn't have to pay for the prior notes and so on and so forth. So is there a harm, number one, in putting up, not a harm, but there should be a legal requirement. There is no harm in putting in the amounts. The bank can adequately do that. And secondly, I think that the borrower, at least in this case, I don't think we could make an assumption that Mrs. Waltke knew what the prior indebtedness was because she didn't sign the prior notes, guarantees that her husband signed. So I think we would want to have, rather than on a case-by-case basis, a bright-line rule that says, let's put in the amount so that the borrowers know and so that the bank knows, so that we don't have this problem. Let's put in, if we can, why not put in the dates of the notes that we're referring to? Let's append that to the mortgage. And one other comment about the ERISA. I see some ambiguity in that. Now, that's a different document than we've got today. But if we look at that ERISA that's attached to that amicus brief, I think that someone can make an argument that it's certainly ambiguous because the very first sentence here says, to induce lender to extend credit. We're talking about future, okay? So some guy signs this because he's going to get future credit. But then we look down at paragraph 2, and we see that it's not just for future. It's for any past debt that this person may have with the bank. Now, do we assume that the person knows that when he's signing a new real estate security agreement which talks about future extensions of credit? I don't know. But I could see, if I'm the lawyer for the debtor, that there's some problem there. There's some ambiguity. And without – I'm not criticizing the Bankers Association, but I think they could do a better job. And why wouldn't you put in the amount? What would be the harm of doing that? What is the difficulty?
Well, it's not a harm. They say they don't know, or that it's possible they can't get their records straight and they don't know. And it's the creditor who should know. And after all, the bank has hundreds and maybe thousands of customers. And after all, the debtor is only one individual and ought to know his own business.
When you go in and get a real estate security agreement, and that is for debt that may become due, no one knows that amount. You would agree. No, at that time, no one knows that amount. So if you're in whatever business you may be in, or if you're in the agricultural business or any other business, I'm sure that lending practices are that some years you might come into the bank and get $50,000, sure. Other years you might come in and get $100,000, depending upon how the crop goes.
Sure.
Are you saying that you would require then this exact amount to be down on that document?
No, not for future. Not for future advances.
Only
past. I'm saying the antecedent advances should be specifically referred to. And I think it's
okay,
good.
Okay, so... But you're anticipating that each year that would be re-signed. So, in other words, when they pay the debt down, this antecedent debt, in other words, the debt you had before, becomes, say, $100,000 debt becomes $37,500, then you would require that to be on that document. See, you have revolving credit plans that are out there,
sure.
in which I think are traditional in many businesses. I'm just wondering how you would require one of those to be signed each and every year then for the exact amount of the past debt to be known.
Well, here's how I would do it if I understand this correctly. If I'm a banker using a real estate security agreement in a situation like you're talking about, the initial one is signed. If there's a need to sign additional real estate security agreements, which I don't really know if there would be, because you'd have the one to begin with.
Right. Which has, let's say, the original debt was $100,000, but now it's paid down to $37,000, and now they're coming into another year and they may want future money. See what I mean?
Sure. I don't think the real estate security agreement has to be modified or changed. All I'm saying is that I think initially when these real estate security agreements are signed, we should have a reference to what the past debt is so that everybody knows, so that there's no question about it, so that we know it covers all debt, not just debt that was incurred supposedly on May 7th, 1987. And that's the problem the trial court had, and I think that's a very legitimate concern in this case.
I had a question to you. I sort of found that the Schmitz case and the John Miller case were not quite consistent. And John Miller is a 1972 Supreme Court case, and Schmitz was a 1987 Court of Appeals case. And John Miller seemed to indicate that you needed to identify the past debt, and Schmitz, at least, is some of the language is being used to indicate that you don't necessarily have to specifically identify it. Do you have any trouble on that?
Well, I think the Schmitz case is a little narrower, but I notice in Schmitz at page 875, the court again says, or the debt, or where it is antecedent, it must be identified in clear terms. If we look back at Badger, what is it, Badger State Agri? In that case, they did specifically list all the prior debt. I think it was like $239,000. So that was not a problem for the bank back then to do. They simply listed right in the mortgage. Or no, I don't know if that was a RESO or a mortgage. That was a mortgage. In the mortgage, they said all the past debt was listed. And that's what we're saying should be done in these cases, at least with a mortgage. And I would think with a RESA, too. In fact, Mr. Croak says that's what they do at their bank. That's good banking practice.
And Schmitz, was it a RESA?
Schmitz was a RESA.
Right. Okay. And the other court said that you could assume the debtor knew the scope of his prior indebtedness when he signed the RESA.
That's what the court said.
That was a RESA.
Right. Okay. And that assumption issue, an assumption is not necessarily a presumption, and it gets a little foggy what it is, but I don't have it right in front of me, but I think one of the treatises I've signed, whether it's Osborne or the other ones, specifically said, here it is, Real Estate Finance Law by Osborne, if they are not so identified, this is prior debt, this is at page 15 of my brief, if it's not so identified, it is assumed that the parties did not intend to secure them. So that's a little different viewpoint of what's, I think, dicta in the case you just cited, Your Honor. So our position, Judge, is that the note's not proven, if there even is a note. I don't know if there's a note or not.
Mr. Rosenbeck, I didn't take notes, and I guess I could listen to the tape, but maybe you could do it real quickly for me. When I said to you earlier that, at least my understanding of the law is that when a complaint is not answered, it is deemed admitted. And you said that that's not applicable in this case or something. What's your authority for that? Or what's your argument?
Sure. My argument, Judge, is simply this. Under Section 840.07, which pertains to real estate foreclosure actions as well, the statute says very briefly this, quote, no default judgment may be granted unless evidence supporting the court's findings and conclusions is in the record, unquote. There's also case law.
But what does that have to do with the law that says when you don't answer a complaint, it's deemed admitted?
Well, because the court has to go past that and still see whether or not the facts entitling a person to default judgment are valid. In this case, the court said they were not valid, that there was no note. That there was no proof of a note. That even if the Walkies may have said there was by their non-answer, the court said, sorry,
well, the court could be wrong.
Pardon me?
The court could be wrong. We're examining the trial court's decision right now for its accuracy.
Well, right. The court could have made an erroneous finding of fact. I don't disagree with that. I don't think it did. But the court is not, just because someone does not answer a complaint, the court is not bound to enter judgment. The fact that a party may be in default cannot confer a right to judgment upon a claim not recognized by law.
I just looked at the complaint, and among other things, the complaint against the Walkies in essence says, we, the bank, lent you, on two different occasions, $50,000 and $25,000, and they haven't been repaid. That's what the complaint says.
Absolutely.
And Walkie says, I don't answer that question. So why can't we just take that as proof that this mortgage does refer back to that $50,000, to that note? I mean, it just seems so. I'm just having a lot of trouble with
okay.
the case.
Okay. Well, here's what we argued to the trial court. I think asked this question at the end of the case, the same question you're asking. And my position is this: the court cannot confer a right on the bank where no right is deserving. If Mr. Walkie walked in and said, I owe everything, I signed the note, I did everything, the court still has to examine the facts to determine if it's accurate that they could that the court could give a default judgment.
And that's your, is that specific to real estate? Is 840 specific to any kind of default in real estate as opposed to a general default?
It is, and it's a funny statute, Judge. Just real quick, Justice, real quickly, 840.07 pertains to real estate actions. We tried to find out the history of it, and it's very, there's nothing that we could find. It's 1973 Supreme Court order, and I don't know why that was in there, because it's case law to begin with that default judgments may don't have to be granted unless the evidence supports the same. But anyway, that's in that real estate section, and it's cited in my brief as well. All right. I'm finished. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Wilsonak? Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
The initial question, is there adequate evidence in this record to establish that obligation of the May 7th, 1987 vote note? Now, we say beyond any question that evidence is there. I mean, the loan records of the loan department are there. The general ledger of the bank is there. And we have the admission of Walke that note existed, all of the terms as alleged in the complaint existed. It's all present. Now, think of the absurdity of setting that aside. Here is Mrs. Walke coming forward, admitting all of the allegations of the complaint. And if Mitchell Bank is deprived of enforcing that mortgage, she is going to wind up in this case with her protected one-half undivided interest.
That admission isn't in the record as an evidentiary matter, though. It's in the record as a default matter.
Well, it could be. And at the conclusion of the evidence, the record discloses that the Mitchell Bank moved for a default judgment against the Walkes because they had admitted all these allegations. That was denied on the theory that somehow this mortgage had evaporated because we couldn't produce that note. Now,
Counsel, can I just interrupt you for a moment? I'm looking at the complaint that Mitchell filed.
Right.
And that complaint says on May 7th that the Watkeys executed a real estate mortgage and that it was then recorded. Obligations to the bank incurred in past or incurred in future, including personal guarantees. This, I can't see in this complaint a reference that on May 7th, a note was signed. So even if they admitted everything in this complaint by failing to answer, all they're admitting is that on May 7th, they executed this mortgage. And they may be admitting that they are owing principal of $74,000 plus interest. Still doesn't say anything about a May 7th note.
No, but the note, I mean, the mortgage recited the existence of the note.
Well, the mortgage is cited here, and it's attached here to a copy of it.
Sure.
But no, I still don't see where it says that they're going to admit that there was a May 7th note. Now, maybe I've missed something. It's not in the complaint. It's only a total amount of interest plus principal.
Well, I think I don't have the complaint in front of me, but I mean the allegation is that they signed a mortgage which secured repayment of a note dated May 7th in the amount of $50,000.
It says and his wife executed a real estate mortgage recorded on June 7th at 9 by the Register of Deeds, copy attached, and it just says obligations to the bank incurred in the past or to be incurred in the future, including liability for personal guarantees of the obligations of others. Now, I'm not that familiar with the record, but I do look at the docket sheet here, and I don't see an amended complaint So I'm just going on the basis of the initial complaint, and it doesn't refer to any May 7th note.
No, but the mortgage does.
The mortgage does. I totally agree
so,
with you.
So, I mean,
but,
this is really a... This
you
is,
have to say that there's an admission by saying that you executed the mortgage, then you're admitting that there was a May 7th note. That's your, that would be your argument.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what we're trying to do really is enforce the mortgage. And counsel made reference to the fact that, that really the reference there is that mortgage references all debt. It also references a May 7th, 1987 obligation. Now, clearly, what happened here was there was, as Judge Babich has traced it, this disbursement of money occurred in September. There was a renewal in December. There was a renewal in March. And then there was, that was an unsecured note. And when Mr. Welke began to have some financial difficulties, obviously, this was then, this mortgage was presented for the purpose of giving security to that obligation, which started back in September. It also was designed to give collateral security to these guarantees that Welke had given to his friends, Butler and to Miracle Shield. It seems pretty clear what happened here. And then when you go to the loan ledger and the general ledger, you find precisely what happened. That $50,000 advanced in September was never paid. And the amount that was guaranteed to Butler was never paid. And the amount of Miracle Shield, a limit, there was a higher loan, but it was, the guarantee was limited to $5,000. It was never paid. And the ledgers are absolutely precise on that issue.
The $45,000, which is the subject of the February 87 paid? Do the ledgers show that precisely?
Well, there was discussion. You're talking about the testimony of Crope in the deposition. I don't think there's any question that he was confused about that. And his counsel has admitted in the brief, when he got on the stand at trial, he corrected that. And so he recognized in reviewing this more carefully that this was the sequence of the obligation. Money was paid in September of 1986. These were 90-day notes. And when they got close to the renewal in
February, was that paid or was that not?
Well, there was no February note. There was a...
Right here in the record.
No. Well, Crook did make reference to a $41,000 February note. That may have been the case, but that's a separate piece of business. That's not what we're involved in here. I mean, the sequence is inescapable. The proof is unrefuted that this was a sequence of a $50,000 note renewed on 90-day intervals. And that's what that mortgage was for. And for the trial judge somehow to get troubled by that, and it's really unclear in the end why the trial judge ruled against this mortgage. I think, in essence, conceding what you've referenced before, the trial judge said because that note was missing, the mortgage evaporated. And that is not and should not and cannot be the law. One other comment about this. The Welkes obviously consented to this foreclosure judgment. If we follow the ruling of Judge Foster in the Court of Appeals, Mrs. Welke is going to get back her one-half interest in this property in Genesee. Now, isn't that absurd? And that, yet, is what counsel is talking about. And that's what the trial judge did in this case. At the end of the hearing, I said, whatever can be said about this, the bank is entitled to a default judgment against the Welkes. And they were. And we can't escape from that that consequence. Now, one other significant thing on the note proof. Isn't it interesting that Mr. Shankey never took the stand in this case? To a question about whether there's enough evidence in the record. Of course there's enough evidence in the record. And if he's speculating about the fact that this note never existed or somehow this is all unproved, he didn't even take the stand. What kind of contrary evidence is there in this record? Why was the recitation in the briefs is that Shankey took a judgment for $20,000 on May 19th of 1987. Now, obviously, they didn't docket that judgment. By the way, that's in the record. It's Exhibit 28. They didn't docket the judgment because it didn't show up in the title report, which is in the record. See, that if that judgment was entered, and it was a default judgment, but it was never picked up in the title report. What happened later was that they foreclosed on that judgment, and that's how Shankey got a 50% ownership in this property. But stepping back from it, there is overwhelming proof in this record to establish that the obligations of the Mitchell Bank were not paid. And they give specific amounts that were not paid, including interest. And that mortgage simply should not be disregarded. A final word about the Bragnet clauses, which is my colleague's area. The fact is, when it's all said and done, there's a lot of confusion in those Dragnet cases. There's a lot of dicta in those cases. But the fact is that the banking industry in Wisconsin has not gotten a clear indication from this court or from the legislature that you must list pre-existing debt to make those omnibus Dragnet clauses work. Now, if this court in this case wants to do this, as Justice Abramson has suggested, prospectively and say, hey, we say that if you're going to secure pre-existing debt with a mortgage, you must list that pre-existing debt. But recall with me that there is not a single one of those cases cited in these briefs in which enforcement of a Dragnet clause was ever denied. Because there's all of these cases, including Capicosa, where they let the spouse off the hook because she didn't know about the debt. But even in Capicosa, and particularly in Capicosa, the Supreme Court enforced that Dragnet clause in any circumstances where there was no reference to either future or past debt.
Mr. Brown. Your light's been on.
Thank you.
I want to thank you, Mr. Brown, and you, Mr. Knight, and you, Mr. Wilson, for an argument in a difficult case. The court has no oral arguments this afternoon, but I see everybody is hungry and has left. But Mr. Justice Crooks will return so that he is with the students and anyone who wishes to stay. Court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.